WWTB 86 AM via talk radio. And we are now joined by someone who I've had an immense amount of respect for since I've been following his career in the think tank focused on security affairs space for the last 18 years, from when I was a junior in high school until now, where I have the privilege of reading his columns and understanding them just a little bit more by virtue of also being involved in the think tank community. Clifford D. May is the founder and president of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a nonpartisan policy institute focusing on national security created immediately following the 9/11 terror attacks. Under his leadership, FDD has become one of the nation's most highly regarded think tanks and a sought-after voice on a wide range of national security issues. Those issues we hope to ask him about today. Cliff, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Greg. Good to be with you.
So let's get right into it. You wrote this article in the Washington Times, I think today. It appeared this morning
It's been this morning's paper, yeah.
About anti-Semitism and Corbyn's devastating loss, but also focusing more on the executive order that was passed by the president last week. I don't want to speak about domestic politics per se, since we are focusing on the Middle East. But I want to kind of parry this to another place, which is the focus on what you call the stunning rejection of Jeremy Corbyn, the party leader who has called members of Hamas and Hezbollah his friends. And what does this mean now for UK Middle East foreign policy? We've had the rejection of the Labour Party platform, which would have immediately had ceased UK arms sales to Israel, and the potential recognition of a state of Palestine. I put that in quotation marks. What does this mean for the Tories' foreign policy and for its relations with Middle Eastern states?
Well, look, this has meaning. It's not huge meaning. Part of what I try to argue today is that anti-Semitism is an ancient and shape-shifting pathology. And those of us who want to fight anti-Semitism, the anti-anti-Semites, should recognize that this is a forever war. Anti-Semitism is not going away. We're not going to cure this pathology. It can, however, be treated. The reason I mentioned the EO, and just very briefly in this regard, is because what President Trump did is to say anti-Semitism is rampant on American college campuses. As the laws are now interpreted, Jews are not protected as other minorities are. This executive order says Jews also should be protected as are other minorities facing discrimination. Jeremy Corbyn is anti-Semitic, quite blatantly so, quite obviously so. He was rejected, I think, not primarily because of his anti-Semitism. This was, I think we know, mainly a vote for Boris Johnson, who said, let's get on with Brexit. Let's get this done. It's been 3 years. It's enough talking about it. And they said, yes. I hope to an extent it was also a rejection of socialism. Jeremy Corbyn is a socialist. And I hope that people in Britain thought, no, we don't want to go back to that. That means all of us become poorer, fewer, less opportunities for everyone. We don't want that. But not having, Jeremy Corbyn has not resigned yet. He will. He won't be leader of the Labour Party. He won't be prime minister. That's good news. But here's what is important to recognize. Well, British Jews who had been leaving the Labour Party, and some of them were packing their bags to go elsewhere, to Israel, the United States, Australia, somewhere they feel safer, that they can now unpack. Nonetheless, there was a report prepared by what's called the Jewish Labour Movement, and it was submitted to Britain's Equality and Human Rights Commission. And it details what it calls relentless anti-Semitism within the Labour Party still. So this is not over in Britain by any means. Right. That said, Boris Johnson's policies will be much friendlier to Israel. I believe they're already talking about an anti-BDS resolution, a law, understanding the extent to which BDS, this campaign to boycott, divest, and sanctions Israel, is based and is on anti-Semitism and is fundamentally anti-Semitic in its intent. Boris Johnson seems to understand this. So it's, you know, this is good news. I say these are both battles won in this endless war against this very specific brand of bigotry.
Right, and I see that as reflected in your column. I mean, if we want to sort of create two prototypes right now for types of politicians that I have, that I would argue have responsible policies towards combating anti-Semitism, and then on the other hand, promoting a responsible foreign policy towards the Middle East. Johnson has, and I just got back from Westminster yesterday, so I did that, you know, during the day flight rather than the red eye flight, London to Los Angeles. And there was some conversations going on and some op-eds in the Times. There was one in the Evening Standard News. There was another one which appeared in the Daily Mail, all saying that there is now certainty or a level of certitude which has returned to English, British, UK policy making, where no one knew what was going on with Brexit. No one knew how to exactly root out anti-Semitism from within the labor movement, like you pointed out to that Jewish labor movement report that came out in September. But back to policy, there's two prototypes I think of global politicians and how they deal with Middle East policy. You have Trump, you have Johnson, you have, to a certain extent, I think, Matteo Salvini, you have other individuals, perhaps Viktor Orban in Hungary. You have the new Prime Minister of London, excuse me, not of London, of Australia, who just came in a few months ago. And they've all said the Middle East is a place that we have to engage with. But then this is where they have a little bit of a different take on it. They say we have to engage with it in order to prevent its quibbles and its troubles coming to affect us here at home. Now, if you have a Jeremy Corbyn, he's saying, well, there's no problem in the Middle East. It's okay for Iran to have power. It's okay for Syria to project itself. We have to recognize Hamas. That's one interpretation, which is completely different, I think, from any responsible policy. That's an irresponsible policy. Vladimir Putin, irresponsible. But when it comes to the politicians that I mentioned previously, they both reject anti-Semitism and the, you know, like you called it, a pernicious form of hatred, a shape-shifting hatred that does not have any way to extinguish itself. It can't go extinct. It always, generation after generation, millennia after millennia, finds a new way to rear its ugly head. But the policies of Johnson and of Orban and of Trump, yes, they have their marked differences, but there's this one common theme, which is that we recognize that there's a right for Jews to live over there. And beyond the Israel question, we recognize we have to engage with the region with actors that are defending our side, which have a commonality of anti-Iran, anti-Shia extremist, anti-Muslim Brotherhood. How do you characterize this sort of common thread, if you believe there is one, between these most recently elected leaders in the last 2, 3 years in their common shared view of the Middle East?
Well, I think there are two important aspects to it. One is the recognition that among the enemies of free nations are the various regimes, movements, organizations, and ideologies that I would characterize as jihadist or Islamist, radical Islam. There are various terms people prefer, and we can discuss why, but I think we should know what they mean. The Islamic State obviously is committed to a jihad against the West, but the Islamic Republic of Iran is no less committed to that. People like Foreign Minister Javad Zarif is more forkable, if you would permit the word. In other words, you can go to a restaurant in Vienna and know which fork to use. But he also believes in a jihad against the West, and he is a neo-imperialist for the Islamic Republic of Iran. I always say Islamic Republic of Iran, because I think the Iranian people, by and large, I think there's some evidence for this, are as fed up with Islamist and theocratic government as any people in the world are. I think you can see that from the protests that recently broke out, demonstrations in more than 100 cities, at least 1,000 people we believe to have been murdered by the regime. People are fed up with what they've experienced since 1979. When the ruling class of Iran became the religious class of Iran, and a specific segment of the religious class, not all of the imams and mullahs in Iran, believe in Khomeinism, which is a very aggressive form of Shiism and imperialism. The Islamic Republic means and is in the process of taking over Iraq and Syria. They pretty much have Lebanon is ruled by Hezbollah, which is absolutely their proxy. They're supporting Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza, as well as, to a lesser, somewhat lesser extent, Hamas. They're supporting Houthi rebels in Yemen. It's pretty clear what they intend to do in the region. And there are those, the leaders you mentioned, who I think recognize this threat and want to frustrate it. And there are others, and I'm sorry to say, including President Obama, who said, no, I think that, you know, the Saudis and the Iranians just need to share the Middle East. And he didn't seem to be terribly worried about the Israeli position within that, or the Jordanian position, by the way, also threatened. So I think that's very much part of it.
Equilibrium of powers, which doesn't matter which ideology you have, as long as your power is equal to someone else, it offsets the potential of conflict. That was the false narrative and false policy prescriptions of Obama. But I do want to get back for a second to the common foreign policy threats of these actors that we mentioned beforehand. Yes, Iran is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, but there seems to be a little bit of a different take when it comes to another power, which is, I think, not necessarily equally as demonic as the Iranians, but as equal in its quest for neo-imperialist, or in this case, neo-Ottomanist ambitions. Why does there exist a united front against Iran? Yet when it comes to Turkey and its misbehavior, Trump seems to be coddling it.
And I'm not entirely sure why that is. A lot of Turkey is a very interesting and as they say, wicked problem, hard to solve. Why? Because, well, Turkey is a NATO ally, but it is not. It is the least reliable ally within NATO. Of course, Turkey also has the second largest military within NATO, the first being the United States. I think there's a feeling right now, a frustration. What do you do? Should Turkey be in NATO? Obviously not. On the other hand, one, there's no mechanism to eject Turkey from NATO. Two, if you do, are you not throwing Turkey even more into the arms of Putin's Russia? There's been a substantial rapprochement between Putin and between President Erdogan of Turkey. Those countries, for a very long time, were rivals and adversaries. And now they seem to have found common cause, perhaps based on the fact that both are led by authoritarians. Turkey does have much wider designs. Turkey is a problem. It just, I think nobody knows quite what to do about it. I think and those of us at FDD, our Turkish portfolio is led by Aytan Erdemir, who's a former parliamentarian in Turkey. And cannot go back. I should make clear he'd be arrested immediately. There's an indictment out for him. The question is, what can be done about Turkey? And I think we're all struggling with that at this point. But we should at least, one thing we're trying to do is just reveal how bad Erdogan is in terms of freedom, and freedom of the press, in terms of all the things he's doing and the meddling in the region. Why President Trump seems, and by the way, all of his predecessors seem to believe that they could get along with him and work with him, and that he was in some way their friend. Again, part of it is tradition and history, and the fact that Turkey used to be considered the secular and pro-Western country in the Middle East. It obviously straddles the Middle East and Europe, but it remains a wicked problem.
So we have these foreign policy prescriptions. Iran is bad. Turkey, I'd say most of the European countries are more anti, or most of the leadership of European countries end up being more cautious, or even to the extent of Emmanuel Macron in France, anti-Erdogan. Trump is the exception within NATO of trying to cajole it back into the warm embrace of the alliance, maybe as a way to get against Putin, maybe as a way to try to balance items out there. But they largely share their cautious behavior towards them. But now a third country comes up in what was once a common approach to Iran, to Turkey, at least holding them to account. Yes, they defer on whether there should be tactics in terms of giving exceptions to sanctions or whatever else. But generally, Iran bad, Turkey getting there. Third country in that axis, which FDD has written about extensively. You had a conference on this subject, I think, a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now. And that's the financier for the Turks, the small peninsular state of Qatar. And you have significant American air assets there at Al Udeid Air Force Base. You have a robust lobbying operation from the Qataris in the United States. They have many investments in Europe, whether it be football teams or Harrods or whatever other commercial prizes they have. But there's also been significant pushback against them, especially in light of the human rights abuses with the World Cup coming up. You had the GCC countries eject Qatar. But all of a sudden, in the last week or two, there's a report in Reuters which described the Qatari foreign minister's description of the détente or the rapprochement between the Saudis and the Qataris. What's happening there?
Well, Qatar is an interesting, tiny little country with a lot of money, as you know, through oil and gas. It's always kind of played both ends against the middle, kind of like a country that's in a way a hedge fund. In other words, it bets on all. It has enough money, it just bets on all the horses, figuring one of them will win, and therefore it will win too. It is, of course, Sunni and really Wahhabi, but and yet. The break with the Saudis has been substantial, and there's talk of détente, but I'm not sure I believe it. But part of what has made the Saudis so angry, and the Emiratis, United Arab Emirates as well, has been both the flirtation between the Qatari ruling class, which is a family, and both the Islamic Republic of Iran and Turkey as well. And as you say, the Qataris also they do a very good job of influence buying other places, including in Washington, D.C. They spend a lot of money at a lot of think tanks. There are think tanks in Washington, quite a few of them that take foreign money, I should say. FDD does not, but others do. And they say, well, that doesn't influence us in any way. I still think it presents an appearance of compromise because Qatar also is a regime that sponsors terrorism in various places. It's a complex piece of the equation, and as you say, also not least because we have military assets based there. The Qataris recognize how useful that is for them.
And I see that, but in your opinion, why are the Saudis talking to them?
Well, look, the Saudis would love to bring them back into the fold of what's called the Gulf Cooperation Council. In other words, the various Gulf states, all of which are Sunni, should be and used to be, to an extent, on the same page. And they do face an existential threat, and I don't use that word lightly, from the Islamic Republic of Iran. There are two ways to deal with an existential threat. One is you face it and confront it and deter it. The other is you say, well, what's the best deal we can work out so you let us live? And again, I think the Qataris have been more the latter. Let's work out a deal so we're not threatened by Tehran. The Saudis are more likely to say there is no deal we can work out with Tehran. They think we're usurpers. They think we should not be controlling the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. They think that we oppress the Shia Arabs in Eastern Arabia, which is where most of the oil lies. There's no way we can work it out. Now, there's two things going on that are interesting there. One is that the Saudis have forever, really, certainly since World War II, relied on the U.S. as, or before that, Britain as their protector. If they feel that the U.S. is no longer a reliable protector, they have only two possibilities, really. One is, again, to try to find some way to work out a modus vivendi with the Islamic Republic so that the Islamic Republic turns its attention to others. The other, of course, and this has already happened, is the Saudis look to Israel with a very different eye. I think at this moment, the Saudis do not at all want to erase Israel from the Middle East. They recognize that, unlike the United States, the Israelis have nowhere to go. And the Israelis are the only nation in the Middle East that has both the will and has the will, the determination, and the military capabilities to confront, to face, to deter the Islamic Republic of Iran. So, very quietly, there have been extensive relations between the Saudis and the Israelis on the intelligence level, on the military level. An Israeli put it in a funny way to me. He said, "Well, they're certainly attracted to us, the Saudis, but
Ha, ha, ha.
It's more like a mistress than a wife. They'd rather not be seen in public with us. We go to small, out of the way restaurants to have drinks.
Well, Cliff, listen, it's 10:30 now. We got to cut this short, but I really want to thank you for joining in one of our last interviews for 2019. It's a pleasure having you on the broadcast. If you could just give us 30 seconds on FDD and how people can read more about your work.
FDD.org is the website. All our columns and our reports and publications will be on there. My columns appear every Wednesday in the Washington Times, both online and in the print edition. And as you say, we were early, you introduced us quite correctly. We were formed just after the attacks of 9/11/01. Amazing to me that was 18 years ago. And it's a pleasure to be with you, Greg.
And give a shout out to Jonathan and Toby.
Jonathan, we have a tremendously good crew there. Jonathan Schanzer, who also worked with Daniel Pipes in years past, and Daniel, I consider a friend and colleague of long standing, so I will give a shout out to him and to Toby Dershowitz as well.
All right, thank you, and have a great holidays and a happy new year.
Same.